Right. We're discussing some points in, I guess you'd call it philosophy, and that is the idea of the chosen people, that God selected a specific people, that's the Jews, for a mission, and the mission is to maintain the Torah, maintain it and keep it and perpetuate the observances and all of the knowledge. And because the Torah is God's revelation to all of mankind, and as we said, the idea of revelation, our concept of Sinai, is that this Torah that God gives us is eternal, and it is exclusive in the sense that it repudiates any other claim of a revelation, that God, there will never be another revelation. This is God's will for the Jewish people and for all of mankind. So therefore, any other system that's based upon the claim that God's revealed something which would repudiate or make any kind of a change or any kind of an addition or any kind of a subtraction from the original revelation is ipso facto a false religion, because it's false prophecy. And that prophet who would make such a claim is liable to the death penalty. Therefore, all other religions in the world, assuming that they're based upon a claim of a divine revelation, are false by definition. So Judaism does not recognize the validity of any other religion. There is only one religion for the Jews and for all of mankind. That is the Torah. The question arises, however, people sometimes ask, if so, why did God have to have a specific people, namely the Jewish people, to reveal the Torah to? Since it's for all of mankind, why did God not reveal the Torah to the entire world? That's the question that we're considering for the moment. So basically, I assume that there's many reasons, but it seems to me a major reason is that the essence of the Torah is not simply the scripture, the Torah Shebichtav, the written part. That's a mistake that the entire world makes. And if you take a look, there are many religions, for example, that claim to base themselves on the so-called Old Testament. But anyone who reads the Mikra, who reads the scriptures, will recognize that it's not something which can be understood simply by reading. The meaning is not contained in the words themselves. It's not self-explanatory. That is to say, for example, you read an editorial in a newspaper, in a good newspaper, or any column by a good writer. And in order to be considered a good writer, doesn't mean necessarily you agree with his views, but you should be able to understand what he's saying. It's clear. It's self-contained. He's explained his point to the best that he could possibly do so. That's considered to be an important characteristic. So it's clear from the statement itself what the intention is. The same cannot be said about the Torah. The Torah was not written in a way that a person could figure out what the meaning is. To the contrary, it's written in a way which is deliberately vague. There's no way to figure out what the intention of the Torah is. On key issues, for example, in terms of Shabbos, that you shall not do any work. But it doesn't tell you what work consists of. All of the mitzvahs, there's no mitzvah that you could really figure out how to do the mitzvah just by reading the text. There's tefillin. There's a reference to tefillin in the Torah. But from that reference itself, to be able to come to the conclusion that this is what it's referring to, these four paragraphs written on parchment and these boxes with these straps and so on. It's true of virtually all of the mitzvahs. It's hard to imagine that anybody could derive an understanding of the mitzvahs and the meanings. So therefore, it's possible for a person to use the scripture as a basis for religion and can project any type of meaning he wants onto it. That's why you have so many different sects amongst the Christians, for example, because they don't have any oral tradition. And it's sort of like the Constitution. You could it lends itself to any kind of a projection. You could spin it around, you could twist it around, you can come to any conclusion you want. with regard to the intention of the author, because you have no way of understanding what the author means. It's one thing in a reading a great work, a human work, a novel, whatever. Even there's always going to be disagreements as to what the author intended. But you have a better chance. You have a better chance because you're dealing with a human mind, and you kind of know how the human mind works and how it thinks, and you know when it's being sarcastic and so on. So a person that's more attuned to these things could have a better opportunity of interpretation. There is a phenomenon of interpretation. You can't interpret the scripture. It doesn't conform to any of the patterns that a person would express themselves in. That you can see even in the stories that it tells. It's very hard. It's sort of like unsatisfying when you read the stories about Abraham and Yitzchak, and you sort of can follow it up to a point, then it goes off in a different direction, and you don't know what's happening. It's not written in a style, a human style that lends itself to knowing what the author intended with any type of certainty. And therefore, if that was all that there was, then the whole venture would be pointless. Because if the objective of God giving the Torah, if we accept that the objective was to communicate His revelation to mankind, so then it would only make sense if God did so in a manner which made it possible for us to understand what it is, that we can live by it. And therefore, if you take a look at the Torah Shebichsav itself, without the reference to the Torah Shebal Peh, there's no way that you can figure out what it means. There's no advance. There's no advantage. To the contrary, it creates all different types of groupings and so forth. Therefore, the essence of the Torah is the Torah Shebichsav together with the Torah Shebal Peh, with all the body of teachings and things that were not committed to writing, except later on, parts were committed because there was the danger that it would be lost and forgotten. But the whole body of the Torah Shebal Peh is really what differentiates us. That's the essence of Yadis. That's the only way that you have to know a jumping point to know the meaning of the Torah Shebichsav. So that's why the Torah could not just be given to mankind. The Torah just be given to mankind, so then it'd be meaningless. Everybody would claim that they have the Torah, and everybody would project their own interpretations onto it. It had to be given to a group of people that was really prepared to accept, to perform all of the mitzvahs. That's one of the main features in the mitzvahs. That the mitzvahs, it's interesting, if you take a look at the Al HaNisim. Let's just combine this discussion with a little bit of the study of Al HaNisim. Al HaNisim and Hanukkah. Essentially, it really is a brief recounting of the story of Hanukkah. It starts off Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol. The time of Matisyahu. Chashmono Yuvanov. Kisham the Malchus Yovan Arshah, when the wicked Greek government arose against your nation Israel. Now let's take a look at the next phrase and let's analyze it. Lashkicham Torah Secha Ulhaviram Mechuche Ritzonecha. What does that mean? To cause them to forget your Torah and to remove them, so to speak, or to cause them to violate your statutes, the statutes of your will, the mitzvahs, basically. So let's analyze that. What is the question that we should raise?
What's the difference between the Torah?
Yeah, why both? What's the difference between the two? Does it not seem a bit redundant or repetitive? You see something very important in the Al HaNisim. That before, because the question arises, why are we going through all this history? Why not just talk about the victory? This is prelude. What do I care about the Greeks? Why not just talk about the victory, that the Greeks were defeated and were driven out of the land and the kingship, independence was restored. Why are we going into this? Important principle. Alanism is really praise. It's hodaya. It's expressing our acknowledgement, our gratitude for the miracle. Shevach and hodaya. There's a general principle in shevach and hodaya. That is that the praise is always relative to the extent of the evil that we were saved from. You have that principle in Haggadah, Maschil Bignus and Messiah B'Shevach, that we start off with the degradation, that we were slaves. That's an argument as to what exactly is the degradation that we're starting off with. But we were slaves in Egypt. Whenever you're giving praise, so you could praise a person for any type of assistance that he gave you. You needed a ride to go somewhere, a person went out of the way, whatever. There's many different things. Many different problems emerge. But let's face it, the extent of the praise is contingent upon your recognition of the danger that you were in. That's why if there was an economic hardship in the land, God helped us. So we have to give praise for that. But that's not the same as what we're talking about over here. If you're on the brink of absolute destruction and God intervened and saved you from that, then the praise is so much greater. The praise is always with regard to the nature of the danger that you confronted. That's what Alanism is doing. It has to set the stage. It has to tell you what the problem was. Because only if you know what the problem was can you appreciate what the extent of the praise, the shevach, was. Well, it's interesting, you don't have holidays for all the different situations that we face in history where we were extricated from a danger. It's not the only, we have two cases. We have the case of Hanukkah and we have the case of Purim. The question was raised, well, what's unique about them? I can't compare this if I go through every case in history. There's been other cases. That's a permanent feature of Jewish history, persecutions. And the fact is that we're extricated from them. But these two are unique in terms of the dimension. That in both cases, the Jews were faced with a situation of total annihilation. Here it was through the Greeks. The annihilation would have been through the destruction of the system of Torah. It was directed at the observance of Torah. And of course, in the case of Purim, it was the physical annihilation of the Jewish people. So these are two situations in which you face the ultimate catastrophe, the extinction of Judaism, whether it be through the destruction of Torah or whether it be through the destruction of the people. It would appear that, there's other factors too, because you had the, it's another important thing over here that, well, let's ask this question while we're on the subject. Let me ask a simple question. What exactly is the nes? What is the miracle of Hanukkah? Anybody will tell you that the miracle of Hanukkah is that there was only enough oil in the Beis HaMikdash when they lit the light for one night, and it burned for 8 days. Went for 8 days until they were able to get new oil. And that's the miracle. But what's problematical about that idea? The difficulty with that, I understand, is that why would it be so important to have such a miracle like that? Because that's a halachic obligation. You're entering into the realm of halacha. That's a mitzvah, it's a chiyuv, and the Beis HaMikdash to light the light. But once you're in the realm of halacha, I said before that time the Greeks were in charge. Now they were able to go back and rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. But once you're in the realm of halacha, so let's say they only had enough oil for one night. And then the next night they wouldn't have any. So what's the problem though? What necessitates a miracle? What's the necessitating factor? Then what? That they won't be able to perform the mitzvah. So then we have a principle of honest Rachmana Patre. That in any case, if you can't perform the mitzvah, that's part of the halachic system itself. If you can't perform the mitzvah, so you're apart from the mitzvah. People that can't fast are potter from fasting. People that can't eat matzah for whatever reason are potter. And it's, in general, you know, it doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that a person would even pray for, a miracle. For example, on Sukkot, the rain, you put there. People don't pray that it shouldn't rain so we can go in the Sukkot. I mean, you just follow the halachic process. It's also interesting because of the halacha pertaining to women. Are women obligated in Ner Chanukah or not? Question, however, is why should women be obligated since it's a mitzvah saseh shazman grama? Principle is that women are exempt from mitzvah saseh, meaning positive commands that are time bound, that are dependent upon time. And even though this is a mitzvah the Rabbanan, the same rule applies. That when the Rabbanan enact a mitzvah, if it's saseh, it's man grama, so women are patur. So why are women chayav? The halachic answer is afhein ha'isabios ha'ines. We have that in a few cases, but for as well, that they too were involved in the nes. But there are two opinions as to what exactly the nes that they were involved in was.
Another question. I understand that principle.
Well, so either you say that it's the basic miracle. The basic miracle, they too were saved from the affliction that the Jews were under. Then there are those that say that no, that they were involved, that the nes occurred through a woman, through Yehudas, who killed the Greek general. Because they had a decree that every arusa, every girl that was betrothed, would have to have relations with the general. That was another form of humiliation. And she killed him. And that was a major turning point, whatever the case may be. But you see, in terms of mentioning that they too were involved in the miracle, it doesn't refer to the miracle of the lights, which would indicate that the real miracle is not the miracle of the lights. Because if the real miracle was the miracle of the lights, how does that affect them at all? Then you can't say Afhein. Also, in Al-Hanisim, it doesn't mention anything about the miracle of the lights. It talks essentially about the victory. And at the afterward, there's the Acher Kein. Towards the end it says, Acher Kein, Bo Banecha L'Dvir Beisecha. Your children return to your house, that is, the Beis HaMikdash. V'tiru es Mikdashecha, V'dliku, all it says, V'dliku Neiros, V'chatzros Kachecha. And they lit lights in the courtyards of your holy place. And they established these 8 days. But it doesn't give you the number 8, that the lights lasted for 8 days. That whole part is missing from the Al-Hanisim, which is a good question. If that was the Nais, then we should be giving thanks over that, so why is it omitted from the Al-Hanisim? The idea that's being suggested is that perhaps it is the real miracle is the miracle of the victory. The Jews were oppressed, and not just oppressed, in terms of an enslavement or physical pain. The ultimate objective was the destruction of the Torah, obliteration. And out of desperation, they fought back. And as we read in the Al-Hanisim, they were, from the natural standpoint, from the physical standpoint, they were tremendously outnumbered. It was kind of a hopeless thing. It was a hopeless battle. In any sense of the term, militarily, physically, and so forth, the Jews ought to have been destroyed. They were fighting against the mightiest empire at the time. And they won. Let's use the word miraculously. When people use the word miraculously, it means how it appears to us. It's the kind of thing that we don't see. According to the natural order, it shouldn't have happened this way, but it's miraculous. But then a question always emerges. I mean, there's always people that have this notion. It's something which is ingrained in people. That if there was a disaster, some type of a disaster, and somehow or other one person escaped. Those who escaped from the World Trade Center, miraculously, and they were on the higher, there were people from different levels of the building, different floors levels, miraculously. Use the term miraculously escape because all intents and purposes they should have been killed with everybody else, but just by inches, something happened this way, pushed it over there, and what, and they just escaped. People always have this type of a thing where they miraculously escape from disaster. Now, from a descriptive point of view, yeah, it means to say that I can't explain it, I can't understand it. And there's a certain desire within a person to believe that it was truly a miracle, because everybody wants to feel that they're under God's protection, that they're unique, that they're different, and they don't realize that can contain an element of arrogance, in the sense that, so why are you different than all the others? How come you were saved? Okay, but it's not necessarily arrogant, because the people say they don't know. I don't know why I don't deserve it. However, there's always an element of a question. That's why the Rambam says that the ultimate proof of Torah is not from miracles, because miracles always contain a certain element of doubt. And what is the doubt? Maybe it's just a fortunate set of circumstances. Now crazy things do happen. We have seen this before. Every time there's a disaster, not every time, but very frequently, there is the story of the person who should have been killed, but whatever, because he went to the back, happened to go to the bathroom, and that part of the plane wasn't hit, and the wind came, pushed it the other way, and he ran unscathed, not even a scratch. The fact that these things happen does not necessitate the belief in a miracle. It could be that's the way the natural forces. Nobody understands how the natural forces work. If you had someone who was able to have a complete mastery, understanding of all the natural forces at work, he would explain to you why it happened. But even if he did explain to you why it happened, it's still possible that there's a higher force which governs the operation of the natural forces, and it was the intention of a being outside of the framework to direct the natural forces so it should produce that result. Well, okay, you don't know. Is it just the natural forces being natural forces? Or is it a higher power above the natural forces directing them to achieve a certain result? In this type of a situation, I call it it's a miraculous victory. The term miraculous, again, it's always used. You'll find a team which is seriously out-talented, you know, like you'll always have this. It can happen. A bunch of Bush leaguers can take on a professional team, and 99 out of 99, they're going to get wiped out. And they win a series against them. Everybody's going to use the term miraculous. And things happen, whatever, the other team is seriously off their game, and these guys are unbelievable, whatever the case you want to say. But there's no particular incident which is contrary to the Teva. But the overall situation is very, very contrary to the expectation, to the statistical factor. So people use the term miraculous. And looking back, you just can't believe how everything worked out perfectly. When he hit the ball over here, and this guy tripped, and this guy did all these different things. It's just amazing. That's what brings out this emotion in people. People have a certain need to believe in higher forces. It's like a magical phenomenon, a magical emotion that people have, that there's such a thing as magic going on. Of course, people have that when it's in line with their desires. So what you have over here, historically, would be very similar to the case of the Six-Day War. It's one situation where Israel was besieged on all sides, and everybody assumed that they're facing a very tough situation, even possibly a disaster. And then they broke out preemptively and achieved one of the biggest military victories in history. They destroyed all the enemy air forces in the first few hours, and 6 days. They conquered the entire Sinai. They could have brought down all these other countries, but they stopped. They captured the Golan Heights, the whole so-called West Bank. Well, today it's become a source of tremendous suffering. You see that at the time, however, there was euphoria. It was an amazing time to live through. Anybody who was Jewish naturally had a certain sense of pride. Before that time, I'm talking about assimilated types of Jews, they kept a low profile. But the amount of attention that was given and the sense of pride, and a new type of Jew had emerged, tremendous military victory and so forth. And of course, everybody referred to it as a miracle. But the question remains, I don't know that all the military experts that study it now in retrospect will say it's a miracle, because in retrospect you could look into the mistakes the other side made, and even though they were numerically superior, what about the quality of their forces and their arms and their tactics and their strategies? And it's true that things did work out well for the Israeli side, but these things happen. It's not, there's nothing which is absolutely convincing that it's a miracle. It depends upon your own emotional orientation. If you're inclined to believe that, if you like miracles, you like to believe in that, so you call it a miracle. But I don't know that you could prove it objectively. Beyond a reasonable doubt, let's put it that way. Now, therefore, the same thing could have been said over here. That is to say that the victory in the war against the Greeks, true, it's an amazing type of thing. True, you could use the word miraculous, but you're using it descriptively. But how do you know? It could be good planning, good tactics, you exploited their weaknesses, and then there are certain advantages that happen. You got good breaks. All these things go, and all these things come together. The few against the many, and you have a great strategy, and you have all the motivation in the world, and the enemy is really maybe not that motivated. And then you achieve a quick breakthrough, and then all the natural factors seem to go along in your way, and you achieve a victory. It's miraculous, but how do you know that it's really from the Ashkach? These things can happen in the human framework. So really the miracle is the miracle of the Nitzachon. And we understand why it's so significant, because of what the Greeks were trying to accomplish. What were they trying to accomplish? L'ashkicham Torasecha u'la'aviro mechuk eretzenecha. Alright, we have to analyze that. What are those two things? It seems to me that one idea would be sufficient. If you had to choose, which one would you say? L'ashkicham Torasecha. Once you forget to cause them to forget the Torah. Now once there's no Torah, there's no mitzvahs. The whole mitzvahs are rooted in the Torah. So now the question arises, we can understand the greatness, the magnitude of the victory. But what was the point of the Neros? Why isn't the story of Hanukkah complete without the Neros? Therefore, there was a need, in order to know of a certainty that this was not just good luck, good situation, something which happens in the framework of the natural order, but that this was a result of an ace, that it was a miracle, there needed to be some type of a sign, some type of an indication. So God utilized the situation that they were in terms of the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash, in terms of the Neros, that they only had enough oil for one day. And this lasted for 8 days, so that was an ace min hashamayim. That's not something that could be attributed to the Teva. So that was an indication from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that God apparently wanted to let them know that the victory they had achieved was really a miracle. That it wasn't something that just happened in terms of the natural order, that it was good luck or good circumstances or whatever, which it could very well be. And that's why with regard to the Six-Day War, at this point in time, there's no way that we'll ever know for sure unless God chooses to reveal to us. We had a Navi. We had a Navi and God revealed it, so then we would know. But other than that, it's something that there's doubt. You can make a case for it, but I don't think that you could prove it, because how do you know? The same phenomena could be explained in a natural way. So in this case, it's the same thing. They could have looked back and determined that it's possible that they won because the Greeks made mistakes and circumstances just happened to work out in their favor. Therefore, God wanted to let them know, and the manner of the lights burning would seem to be something which is contrary to the Teva. There's no room for doubt. And that's really the... So there's really one ace. The nace is really the nace of the victory. The two go together now. It's one nace. But if you can't consider it a nace of a victory. The victory can't be considered a nace unless there's something there to demonstrate that it is a nace. And that's the meros. Let's ask ourselves one further question. If then we're saying that the objective of the nace, of the lights, was not for its own sake. In terms of the need of the neros themselves, that wouldn't have been such a problem, so they would have waited till they were able to get the correct oil. Can we explain why God utilized that method to indicate this? Why specifically through the neros? Of course it serves the purpose because it's clearly a miracle, but there are other things that God could have done which would have been contrary to the Teva. Is there any way we can understand why God chose this particular avenue? In answering this question, let's go back to something we raised already in the Alanisim. Because it begins by telling us what the objective of the Greeks was. Lashkicham Torasecha, to cause them to forget your Torah, Ulahaviram, and to remove them from the observance of the Chukei Ratzonecha, the statutes of your will. And we raised the question, why does it have to mention both ideas? See, there's two parts to the Torah. There's the Talmud Torah, study of Torah, the attainment of the knowledge. But then there's mitzvahs. What's the idea of the mitzvahs? The idea of the mitzvahs is that the real perfection is not just from the intellectual acquisition, but it's the internalization, that a person should mold his whole personality in accordance with the knowledge, should live his life in accordance with the knowledge, that it should permeate all of his emotions. He should be in line. The emotion should be in line with the knowledge. That's what really what mitzvahs represent, that we don't just study something in the abstract, but the mitzvah means a performance. To perform it and to act, to live in accordance with the knowledge. That's one thing. But there's another. So in that sense, the mitzvah is really a fulfillment of the learning, of the knowledge, of the Torah. But it works the other way as well. That the performance of the mitzvah is something which helps us to maintain the Torah. That is to say, that how is the Torah preserved? All of the knowledge, all of the Torah Shebaal Peh that's involved. And part of it is through a system of mitzvahs. Because we have to perform the mitzvahs, the Jews accepted upon themselves the performance of the mitzvahs, so the performance of the mitzvahs itself necessitates the study of Torah. Because how can you do the mitzvah unless you study Torah? Now, it's true that each individual person doesn't have to himself have to be an expert in the study of Torah, but he has to have a rabbi to go to. He has to support yeshivas because he knows that he's committed to the performance of mitzvahs. The person that's committed to the performance of mitzvahs. So automatically, he's committed to the perpetuation of Torah, because without Torah, you can't have mitzvahs. So one reinforces the other. The system. The system maintains itself through the study of Torah, of course. You have yeshivos and people that devote their whole life to studying Torah. And it also maintains itself through the establishment of a, so to speak, religion, which is based upon the performance of mitzvahs. So you have a body of people that keep the mitzvahs. As long as you have a body of people that are keeping the mitzvahs, so this guarantees that the study of Torah is going to be perpetuated. Either those people that perform the mitzvahs themselves want to study and understand more. But beyond that, even if they really can't study that much, but they're committed to the idea that the Torah has to be studied, because they recognize that without the study of Torah, you're not going to have the mitzvahs. So therefore, if you have an enemy whose objective is to destroy this particular system, and that's why it's mentioning it over here, the greatness of the miracle has to do with the fact that they were up against a mighty opponent, but not just that he was mighty, but he was very shrewd. He knew how to destroy the system. So it directed itself at two aspects of the system. One is the study of Torah, lashkicham Torasecha, to cause them to forget Torah. Once they are removed, theoretically, a few generations go by and there's no study of Torah. You don't have any scholars anymore, so that's it. You lost the system. Even at that time it wasn't even based that much on books. But even the preservation of the books, if you don't know how to study the Gemara, so the existence of the Gemara itself is not going to save the system. But in those days, it wasn't even based in books. It was based upon people. So the way to attack and destroy the system was through directing yourself against the study of Torah, Lashkichem Torah Secha, to water down, to obliterate, to make it very, very difficult for them to continue to study and learn Torah, and at the same time, to attack them from the angle of performance of mitzvahs. Because the two go hand in hand. Because as long as you have a body of people that are still involved, still connected to Judaism, to the performance of the mitzvahs, and they want to do the mitzvahs properly, so they're going to do everything possible to maintain the study of Torah. So that's the two ideas. It's telling you the real objective was to obliterate the system of Yadis. And the danger was that they came up against an enemy who understood what the foundations were and had to uproot it. And Lashkicham Torah Secha and La'aviram Al-Chukhe Ritzanecha both go together now. So essentially, if we are correct in saying that the nace of the lights was to demonstrate, that God wanted to demonstrate that it was, that the victory was because of his intervention, because of the Hashkacha, so then it's extremely, extremely important. You see, those people that believe that the Six-Day War was a great miracle, and it creates a certain euphoria and a certain exaltation, it's not necessarily a good thing. You know, when people are convinced that a certain thing is a miracle, it doesn't always lead to elevation, to bring you to a higher level. Because it very often can enforce a certain emotion that people have. Because God favors us, that we're God's favorite, and that's why God did the miracle for us. Question always arises in these types of situations as to why. Why did God do this miracle for you? Now, a person that's in that situation, that's saved from a disaster, there's a certain answer, a certain emotional answer that's inherent. He doesn't need an explanation. Why? Because it's him. Because he feels that he should live, that God recognizes his importance. But is that really true? That's a narcissistic type of a phenomenon. It could be a dangerous thing. Because the person is now confirmed his basic feelings about being superior and about being important, and that his existence has a special meaning, even though it may not be based on anything. A truly perfected person is humble. So this idea that he has, and now it's being reinforced, it's not such a good thing. So in informing them that the victory was because of God's help, it was important to communicate to them what the reason, why God came to their assistance. And why did God come to their assistance? Because they were fighting for the preservation of Torah. Milat Hashem Elai. That they stopped the whole trend of assimilation. The Misyavnim, they were the same thing in those days, that there were people that went along with the Greek culture, that they were corrupted by the Greek philosophy. And then the Matisho, a group of people who were dedicated to the preservation of the true ideas of Torah. The whole idea was to destroy the influence of the Greeks and to return the Jewish nation to return to Torah. So that's why it mentions in the Al Nisim that after it tells you about the military victory, so what does it say? V'yachad kein bo banech l'dvir v'secha. Interesting. It's just like describing. Afterwards, that's where they went. That's where. What is it trying to communicate? That's where they went. That's where they went because that after the war, after the victory, they didn't have the sense of exaltation. It wasn't a nationalistic phenomenon. but rather the whole thing was being fought for Kiddush Hashem, to return to the Torah and to cleanse the Beis HaMikdash and to reestablish it. That's Achra came Ba'avanecha. That's where they came. This shows you what their real goal was. Ufinu Asechalecha. They understood that they were. The whole point was not just a military victory, not just for freedom, as that's what people, that's how people relate to the Maccabees today. The reason why Hanukkah is so popular is because Maccabees, you know, human strength and might, and this whole, they think it's the whole idea of freedom. They were fighting for freedom. They weren't fighting for the freedom as these people imagined, for religious freedom. They were fighting for Torah. The Tiras Mikdashecha, the Likuneros, you see? So, because that was the real motive, because they were fighting for Kiddush Hashem, so that's where the Ashkacha comes in. They should understand that. That's the Dafka in that point, in the Neros, because the Neros represented exactly what the purpose of the Milchama was, that's where it manifested itself. And that's extremely important. It's extremely important, because it's not that important necessarily to know whether you won because you did the right things in a natural way, or whether you won because it was a specific miracle. You always have to give shalom to God. You always have to give praise to God. But it's important to know that if indeed it was a miracle, it's important to know. It's a different type of a praise that you give to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But once you know that, then it's absolutely vital to know what the basis. What? Why God intervened in this case? That's the real message. The real message is not just that God intervened and that's why you were saved. That message in and of itself can even have negative consequences. A person can go to his head. A person can feel superior. And that's precisely what did happen, by the way, to the Jewish people after the Six-Day War. There was a feeling of tremendous euphoria. A whole new attitude of superiority and strength and so forth, till they had a come down with the surprise attack of the Yom Kippur War, a trauma, so to speak. You see that from this, that the most important lesson is the reason why God intervened, because that's where the Ashkacha is. When a person decides to get closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the point where they were willing to fight and to risk their lives, not for any personal glory, but for the sake of Torah and Kiddush Hashem, that's where God intervenes. That's the real idea. I just want to make it clear in this respect that we may not know. We don't have these types of miracles nowadays, and we don't have Nevuah. In the case of the Megillah, they knew it was Min HaShemayim because you had Mordechai and Esther. They were on the level of Nevuah. After that, we really don't have this type of situation where if something great happens to us, that we know that it's a Nevuah. However, the halacha is that you have to give praise to God. When a person's in a crash, in an accident, and he escapes, and so on and so forth, you have to give Hodayah LaHashem. Doesn't mean to say that you know for sure that this was the Hashkacha. But there are situations that we go through which cause us to reflect upon God's providence and God's goodness. And it's a chiyuv to give hodayah in those situations. It doesn't diminish. You see, you don't need to know. In order to learn the proper lessons and in order to reorient your relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a result of things that happened, you don't need to know. You sit back and wait, well, I have to find out first whether that was a miracle or it was just good fortune. That's absurd. A person always has to give praise for the benefits that the person obtains. That's not to say that we know. It's interesting, like this past Thursday, I believe it was, the terrorism, the plane,
yeah,
the Arkia plane, the Israeli plane, that's an amazing kind of a thing. That they fire these SAM-7 missiles, they're heat-seeking missiles. They brought down many planes in the Yom Kippur War, many Israeli planes. And miraculously, it missed. People looked outside the window, and it's like a yard away, they said. They saw the puffs. They didn't know what it was. That's a hard one to explain. It's a miracle. Is it a miracle? I don't know. You do not know. Now, those on board have to relate to it as a miracle. From their perspective, it's It's something which causes them to rethink their entire life and to have a whole new relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to give thanks for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. However, to say definitively that God actually that was under the providence and God intervened to make sure that the missiles wouldn't hit the plane, or no, these things can be explained. There are many explanations I give in the papers as to certain defects in the missile or whatever. Other factors which might cause it to miss the plane, it's possible. That's an illustration. But I maintain that a perfected individual who went through a situation like that has to be, his whole way of life should be affected by it, and he has to develop a new relationship with God. That's Hodaya. He has to give Hodaya. That's the halacha. Whether or not he knows for sure what God's intentions were in that particular case. I continue the talk that we discussed this morning. There had to be a particular people that was qualified to receive the Torah. Because what we're talking about in terms of the Torah is the entire system. Of course, the Torah Sheval Peh, to perpetuate that and set up a system where everything in the nation is geared towards the study of Torah. And that's dependent upon the adherence to the mitzvahs as well. That's why you can't just say by giving the Torah like you're giving it over a book. That's meaningless. And that's why there had to be a specific people that was willing to accept upon itself all of the obligations in terms of the shmiras haTorah, the guarding of the Torah, the performance of the mitzvos, establishing the institutions that maintain the study of Torah, and so on and so forth. So that's what it entailed. So that's why God needed a particular nation. You can't just... The Torah is not like a book. Somebody wants the world to have a book, so you just publish a book and give it to all the different countries, and everybody's got the book now. Or everybody has the rights to publish a book. That's not what the Torah is. The bulk of the Torah consists of things that weren't even intended to be written down. So it requires a whole system and the cultivation of an elite group of people who devote their entire life towards mastering every aspect of the oral law and living a certain kind of a life, and it also depends upon a nation that's willing to accept upon itself the system of mitzvahs. It's an interlocking phenomenon. It's a very complex kind of a thing. It's a different kind of nation that will do all the things that are necessary to maintain and perpetuate the Torah. So that requires a specific nation that's willing to dedicate itself to that task. That's why you need a nation. If you just give the Torah, you can't just give the Torah to the world. As I'm just trying to tell you, it's not a book. In a sense, you can see the effect of giving the Torah to the entire world, because in a certain sense, the whole world has the Torah now. The whole Christian world and the Muslim world. They have the Torah without the Torah Shebaal Peh, without the mitzvahs. So what they have is a complete distortion of what the Torah actually is. So now you can trace it back to the beginning. Had God given it that way, to begin with, in the entire world, and then without establishing the foundation for the perpetuation through the Torah Shebaal Peh, so then everything would have been gone. It would have been totally distorted. You needed a group of people that was roy to accept, that was fitting to accept the system. That's the whole story of the creation of Klal Yisrael, to generations. It starts with the Avos and their descendants and all the experiences they went through. And then they went through, even that wasn't enough. They had to go through Mitzrayim and the enslavement and all the different factors that weigh in the idea that this was a heritage from the Avos and so on. All the different complicated factors still you produced a situation where you had a people that was willing, that was willing to accept upon themselves what the responsibilities this entailed. That's the Jewish people. It's a unique phenomenon. The question is being raised as to why the Jews are more qualified. It doesn't mean that the Jews are superior. That's clear. Moshe brings that out in Devarim. Don't say it's a kasi. Don't say that it's because of your righteousness or your yashrus. You shouldn't feel superior to other people. Essentially, there's many factors which qualifies the Jews, but the most significant of those factors are Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. We are the Rak Bavosecha Choshek Arashem Liava Osam. The only ones that God really loved, so to speak, were the Avos, because they reflect the true way the Derech Hashem, how to live in accordance with the will of God. Vayivcha Bazara. Bazara. God chose the Zera. We were chosen because of an accident where the Zera is Chusaros. That's the idea of Chus, Mary of the Fathers. So there's many different aspects to it. That in terms of the plan of establishing a nation which derives its identity from the Avos, who are more suited than their own children, their actual Zera. Not the adopted children, so to speak, of those who came because they converted, or they wanted to follow the system. The system accepts converts. But the core has to be those who are related back to the Avos in that way. And there's many other things. I mean, then the historical experiences that they went through, and then being in Egypt and the enslavement and so on and so forth. Many, many factors. And even then it says, Chazal indicate that it wasn't an easy thing to accomplish. See, the idea of creating an Ummah that was fit to receive the Torah is not an easy thing. It goes contrary to the scheme of things. That's what the Chazal indicate when they say that God offered the Torah to the different nations, and each one wanted to know. You can't steal, you can't do this, and therefore they couldn't accept it. That type of a phenomenon indicates that there's a natural resistance. There's a resistance. There's a hatred for the Jew also, because the Gentiles are envious of the fact that the Jews were chosen. They want the benefits of being chosen, but you see, every other system that came along, immediately they get rid of the mitzvahs. It's the first thing they do. They get rid of the mitzvahs. So nobody wants to live by the mitzvahs. Nobody wants to have their lives governed by the mitzvahs, and by the Torah Shebaal Peh, and all of that. But the two things they do, they get rid of the mitzvahs, and they get rid of the oral law. So each person can now interpret the Torah any way he wants. So basically, you're living according to your own fantasies, and you're just projecting them onto the Torah. That's what the world wants. So it's a very complex kind of a phenomenon. The real question is, how was there found even one people that was willing to accept, to say Nasa v'nishma? But that was the design of the Hashkacha, the design of Providence, Lazarcha, that God would give Avraham children, and they would eventually form into a nation, and the greatness of this nation would be precisely here. That they would be the ones that would be the teachers of Torah, perpetuate the Torah. That's really what Klal Yisrael is. People don't appreciate what Klal Yisrael is. That's the true idea of Klal Yisrael. And unfortunately, today, with the phenomenon of Zionism and nationalism, that's a distortion of the real objective, the real purpose, the real nature of Klal Yisrael. That's the downside of Zionism. Now, of course, I have to be very careful, whoever's listening. Of course, I support Israel, I support the state of Israel, and so forth. But not because of the ideals, the nationalistic and Zionistic ideals, that the secular spokespeople of Israel put forth. That's not my philosophy. I support it because it's Jews, and hopefully someday it'll be moved towards the observance of Torah, and that type of thing. So, practically speaking, 100% support. Philosophically, however, the concept that it represents is not Klal Yisrael. That's not Klal Yisrael. That's the idea of Amleches Kohanim, V'gai Kadosh. The Kohanim factor, to me, indicates the idea of the teachers. Because the Kohanim, Yoru Mishpatech Yaakov, that the Shevet Levi was designated to teach Torah to, of course, to Klal Yisrael. And the Mamlechas Kohanim, the objective is to be the ones who teach Torah to all of mankind. And Gai Kadosh, it's a holy nation. That means that its national existence is different. It's Mugdal, has a different national constitution, a different national purpose. For every nation's national purpose is essentially self-glorification of one form or another. It's culture, it's architecture, things of that sort. That's what the nation stands for. That's assuming it's not an evil nation, which is attempting to conquest and so forth. But the Gai Kadosh indicates that on a national level, it's different. It's Muslim. National purpose is Kiddush Hashem. That's the true objective. That's the true purpose of Klal Yisrael. V'nikdashti b'sof b'nei Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael is a vehicle for the name of God to be sanctified in the world. That all of mankind should come to recognize the Creator. So one can't say that that's the practical objective of the state of Israel in this time. But I don't mean to be blaming anybody. It's not the point. Not to say that I'm blaming the secularists and I'm defending the religious, because, or myself, it's not a question of fault. Everybody is at fault. It's easy to criticize. So the question arises, why aren't the religious doing more to make the true ideas of Judaism known and popular? So I'm not getting into that issue, the secular versus the religious. I'm not blaming anybody. It's not an issue of blame. However, the phenomenon that does exist should be supported, because it marks the return of the Jews, that they can live in Eretz Israel, and we have to defend that. The Jewish people has to be defended, and one should contribute and help and bring it towards the true purpose. The only point I'm making is that as is, if a person is content that this is it, this is the Jewish objective, to have this type of a nationalistic phenomenon, I say that's contrary to the Torah.